It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, Wisconsin has the highest black unemployment rate in the country, according to a new study from the Economic Policy Institute. But first, tomorrow, astronaut Scott Kelly will blast off for a year-long stay on the International Space Station. While he's there, his twin brother will stand behind on planet Earth. Both brothers are doing their part to advance our understanding of space, though. When astronaut Kelly gets back, NASA plans to take a close look at his physical and mental condition, compare it to his twins, to answer the question, how do the human body and mind hold up on long trips in space? Here to help us get a handle on that question is Elizabeth Howell. She's a freelance space science and business reporter. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Well, a year in space, that seems like a long time. How big a deal is a year-long stay on the space station like this one?
It's a huge deal. We haven't seen a mission this long since the Mir space station Russian missions of the 1990s. So this is a rather historic occasion here. Not only that, but the longest stay, on the International Space Station was 167 days or thereabouts. So quite a bit more. And it's going to be that much more challenging for the human body.
Well, what do we know about astronaut Scott Kelly that would prepare him for a year-long mission like this?
He is probably one of the most qualified people to take on this mission because he has been into space 3 times already, including a long stay on the ISS, about 6 months long. And, he just has all those years of experience. He used to be a military pilot. He's worked extensively within NASA for the past, like, 15 years ago or 20 years or so as an astronaut. And even his brother, who you mentioned, Mark Kelly, is an astronaut himself. So it's almost like he has double the experience bundled up inside of him. Quite interesting.
So the twin aspect is a really interesting aspect of this. NASA wants to get at what exactly happens to a body when it's in space in zero gravity for a year. Why do they want to get at that question?
Because if they want to be heading out to an asteroid or they want to be going out to Mars, they need to figure out how to keep the person healthy while they're doing that. When you go into space, your bones weaken, your muscles tend to kind of shrink up because there's nothing to fight against up there. And they also are noticing changes in how your eyes kind of process things, and that can lead to problems like needing glasses when you get back or maybe even worse. They're even seeing changes in how the immune system functions. And so if we want people to be spending longer in space and heading out to other destinations, we just got to make sure that they're healthy while they're doing that.
Is that on the horizon, say a mission to Mars?
Well, that's what NASA's really aiming for. Now, the funding isn't there right now, but what they're saying is that the International Space Station is going to be the spot where they do all these studies on the human body. That way, if and when the funding ever appears, maybe in the 2020s, maybe the 2030s, then they'll have all that background data that they can pull up and say, oh, yeah, you know, we had this one-year mission on the International Space Station. We had all these six-month missions. Here's some data we can use to keep our astronauts safe.
And so part of this is, you know, as we're talking about, how does the body handle this? But what do we know about what the mind might do for a year in space?
Well, that's the other thing, too, because if you're sitting in a small area, you know, they're about the size of a trailer or two up there in space, it's isolated. It's confined. You can't really go outside very easily for a lot of reasons, including the fact you can't breathe. So you're just stuck inside of there. You have to figure out ways to keep yourself entertained with a small crew that you see every single day. It's hard to get away from them. Your family, naturally, is far from home, far from where you are. So it's a big psychological mind game almost, sort of thinking, how do I stay focused? How do I make sure I stay happy, you know, interactive with my crewmates, productive for the mission? And you're right. It's another huge challenge they're going to have to figure out.
It was interesting. I think I read that Scott Kelly and I guess his twin brother are 51 years old. Is there anything about age? I mean, it surprised me at first that NASA would be sending someone who wasn't in their 20s or 30s into space. What do we know about the age factor?
Well, the age factor, the older you are, the more experienced you are. And that's what NASA really is looking for in its astronauts these days, because when you're older, you tend to have that background behind you. You know how to handle a lot of life experiences. I mean, for example, Mark Kelly, who was Scott's brother, Mark's wife, Gabrielle Giffords, there was an attempted assassination shortly before Mark's mission. So he really learned about dealing with the stressors of a situation in space, probably passed on some advice to Scott about that. And really, this sort of thing comes with experience. You just sort of have that background about things that you can draw upon, experiences in your past life, and especially with 3 missions behind him, Scott Kelly is going to be a good fit for this.
We're talking with Elizabeth Howell right now about a unique space study that's kicking off tomorrow as astronaut Scott Kelly spends an entire year in space. And do we know how long it will take to collect the data from this? He's going to be gone for a year and then presumably a lot of testing to go through.
A lot of testing, and some of it's going to be ongoing while he's out there. So, you know, they'll be doing kind of tests every couple of weeks or maybe every day where they're looking at his bones, at his muscles and his mind, things like that. And then you're right, you know, even after he comes back to Earth, there's going to be that long recovery period. Usually the metric that they have is for every day you're in space, it's going to take 1 day to recover on Earth. So if he spends 365 days up there, it'll take him 365 days to recover down here.
Really?
So they'll be doing a lot of, studies when he comes back, trying to make sure that he gets healthy. And then, it might take another couple of years before all the results are released. But knowing how excited NASA is, I'm sure they're going to be putting out as much as they can, as quickly as they can.
Now, I didn't know we thought of going to space as something that you had to recover from, like a cold. Specifically, what are you recovering from?
Well, because you're out there for a year, in this case, and you're weightless, your body just isn't used to gravity when it comes back. And so everything feels heavy, even just lifting up your hands or your head. Chris Hadfield, who is a Canadian astronaut, spoke about this quite eloquently when he came back. He said his spine was hurting. You know, everything was an effort. He couldn't stand up in the shower because he was afraid he was going to fall. So all of this takes extensive rehabilitation, and they're used to this at NASA. They have doctors on hand, and they have a personal flight surgeon that watches what the astronaut is doing before and during after flight. So I'm not saying that they're not prepared for it, but it's still an immense challenge. You know, it's like, I guess it's something like training for a marathon, you know? You go up there, you come back, there's a big recovery time, a big hurdle. So that's something you're really going to have to watch with Scott Kelly and also Mikhail Kornienko, the Russian astronaut, will be going up there.
So why are these important questions right now? We don't even have an active space shuttle program anymore, let alone money for a mission to Mars. So why put Scott Kelly through this?
Well, we're putting him through this because the space station has been up there for about a dozen years, 15 years now, with human occupation, right? Since about 99. I can't do the math right now. But anyway, so the station's been up there for a number of years, and they're trying to push it as far as they can before they bring the station back down to Earth. They're going to kind of break it apart in the atmosphere. That could happen as soon as 2020, although the U.S., of course, wants to extend it to 2024. It depends on what all the international partners want to do. So what they're trying to do is just get as much use out of the station as possible in terms of things like human health. They have a bunch of 3D printers that are going to go up in the station in the next while, so a lot of exploration of like manufacturing. Even things like just trying to make things off of Earth or how people react in small environments. These are all things that can be useful for a lot of other research studies, maybe even not space studies.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Howell is a freelance space science and business reporter talking about astronaut Scott Kelly's historic 1 year on the International Space Station. He's going up tomorrow. His twin brother is staying behind on planet Earth. First, Wisconsin tops the nation for black unemployment, according to a new report from the Economic Policy Institute. At nearly 20% unemployment, it's almost double the national average of 11%. The report also looked at the rate at which different racial groups in the country are recovering from the recession and what unemployment rates might look like for the coming year. The author of that study joins us now. Valerie Wilson is the director of the Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy at the Economic Policy Institute. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, your report shows Wisconsin has the highest black unemployment rate in the country at almost 20%. How does that look compared against the rest of the country?
Well, yeah, in fact, you know, Wisconsin does have the highest rate in the country. There are a few others that are not far behind Wisconsin. Second is Nevada at 16.1%, Michigan at 15.8%, and then the District of Columbia at 15.7%.
Now, can you put those numbers into a bit of context for us? How does that compare with joblessness during the recession, where we're looking to recover from?
So in each of those states, the unemployment rate remains above where it was before the recession. That is actually the case in all but two states in the nation in terms of the black unemployment rate. Those rates are much higher in Wisconsin. But still, in most states, the African-American unemployment rate has yet to recover.
Now, among the states that you looked at with high black unemployment rates, specifically Wisconsin, are you left with a sense of why those rates are still so high?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the economy in each state. So the three states that are at the top of the list, were hit pretty hard during the recession. And so overall, unemployment increased during that period. But it is especially high for African Americans when you consider that the populations tend to be more concentrated within those states, within large cities. And, for example, Milwaukee, has a disproportionate share of manufacturing jobs, which we know took the hardest hit during the recession. We also know that there's higher shares of African Americans with less than a college degree in many of these states, and so those populations continue to struggle with being reemployed in the recovery.
So are these states that have these higher rates of black joblessness, you're saying they're also seeing lagging economic recovery across the board?
Yes, in many of them, that's the case. But, you know, in other instances, again, I think it's a matter of the labor market being stratified in terms of the kinds of jobs that are growing and just differences in the population that's seeking employment.
Is there a profile of states like Wisconsin with high African-American jobless numbers when it comes to other factors? You get a more complete picture if you look at things like, say, infant mortality and poverty and incarceration.
Well, again, across the nation, you know, there are higher rates of incarceration for African-Americans than other groups. But I would say that, I think that you tend to see, again, higher rates of concentrated poverty in large urban centers, lower levels of education among the African American population, and I say lower levels. Again, nationally, that tends to be the case, but I think the gaps are much wider in these states where we see the higher black unemployment rates. And so there are a number of factors playing into why the rates are so high in these areas. And on top of that, just in terms of the how hard the state economy or even the city's economy was hit during the recession.
Now, just to zoom in on the Midwest for a moment, Wisconsin isn't the only Midwestern state that has these high African-American unemployment numbers. There's Michigan, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri. They all had high rates as well. Wisconsin was at the bottom of that pack. But what are the dynamics at play in the region in general, in the Midwest?
Again, I would say a lot of that has to do with the fact that manufacturing took such a hit in the recession. And those were jobs, you know, pretty well-paying jobs that were available for working-class Americans. And working-class, I'm saying people with less than a college degree. The fact that those industries were hit especially hard and have, you know, lagged in recovery, that has factored into why we're seeing such wide unemployment rate disparities by race in the Midwest in particular.
What data did you look at to come up with these numbers?
So the data that we use comes from the current population survey, which is the data that's available each month to give us our national statistics on unemployment rates. But we also use another BLS data source, the local area unemployment statistics, that focuses specifically on state unemployment rates. And between the two of these, we looked at the ratio of the unemployment rate for a specific racial population in an area over the last 6 months to sort of smooth things out, because the unemployment rate tends to bounce around. And then we use those ratios with the local area unemployment statistics to estimate our state unemployment rates by race. The Bureau of Labor Statistics provides state unemployment rates by race, but only on an annual basis. And so our quarterly estimates and our projections for the fourth quarter of 2015 are developed through EPI's methodology for estimating those.
Now, just looking at the unemployment numbers, as I understand it, doesn't always tell the whole picture, because it doesn't include people who've left the workforce. So if we included those people back into the sample, does that mean that Wisconsin's numbers for black unemployment would be even worse?
Oh, absolutely. You'd see a much higher jobless rate, or, you know, what some people call the real rate of unemployment. Part of what I did in the study, beyond just looking at unemployment rates, because we know that the unemployment rate can fall if unemployed workers stop looking and therefore cease to be counted. But one of the other indicators that I looked at is the employment population ratio, and that's the share of the working age population with a job. So in the case of Wisconsin, at the same time that we saw the unemployment rate increase, We also saw a decline in that employment population ratio, pointing out the fact that there in fact was less employment opportunity available to African Americans in that state.
So what does that tell you big picture when you look at that that factor that you're adding in now?
Well, that says in Wisconsin in particular, we know that the increase in the black unemployment rate came about because there's been a loss of employment, at least over the last year. So that's from 2013 to 2014. In some other states where we saw the unemployment rate decline, in some, we did not see on the other side an increase in that employment population ratio, indicating that that decline, may be affected by people leaving the workforce. But in others, we saw that at the same time that unemployment rate declined, that we did see an increase in employment. So it's really a mixed picture across the country that to me really tells the story of differing degrees or a variance in the pace of recovery across different states.
Stepping back now to get the big picture, your report looks at how different groups of people are recovering from the recession, not just African Americans. What did you find big picture?
So in terms of looking at each of the groups, we found that whites and Latinos are much closer, again, to pre-recession unemployment rates than African Americans are, although still there's still some room there are still some progress that needs to be made in order to say that we're at a full recovery. And even for those groups that are closer to recovery nationally, that varies by state.
And you also look at Hispanics and Asians in particular. You said they're doing better. Hispanics are. How would you say, or why would you say that is the case right now?
Well, part of it has to do with the fact that for each group, we are not able to observe the data for all states because it's just based on the population size in that state and the fact that the current population survey is a survey, so it doesn't interview every individual. It's just a sample of households. So we have different sets of states that we're able to observe for each group. But again, nationally, what we tend to see in terms of unemployment rates is that whites and Asians typically have the lowest unemployment rates, and that's in good economic times and bad. African Americans typically have the highest, and Latinos fall somewhere in the middle.
We're talking with Valerie Wilson right now about rates of African American unemployment in Wisconsin and beyond. And Valerie, your report, what did you find as far as the gap goes between African Americans and whites nationally?
So nationally, the black-white unemployment rate gap is, nearly 2-1, and it's been nearly 2-1 since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been reporting those. It's a little above that now, maybe 2.1, but that's typically the case. Where we tend to get more variation is when we go down to the state level and look at that. So, for example, some of the largest gaps are in, for example, the District of Columbia, where the black unemployment rate is nearly five times, or more than five times, the white unemployment rate in our nation's capital.
And just briefly, you projected declining unemployment for 2015. Do you think that's going to help these numbers for minority groups who are still dealing with high unemployment?
The decline in the unemployment rate over the last year, and we know that last year was the strongest a labor market year in terms of job growth that we've seen in the recovery. We, in fact, saw that unemployment rates fell more for African Americans and Latinos, and that those improvements in the unemployment rate were accompanied by improvements in the employment population ratio. So we saw a larger share of those populations being employed at the same time that we saw an increase in the labor force participation, so people were being drawn into the labor force, all of which are good indicators. So assuming that we continue along that same path, and the projections that we use indicate that we are expected to have about that same pace of job growth over the next year, we would tend to see that the rates would fall more for African Americans, although it still wouldn't get us back to pre-recession unemployment rates.
Valerie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Valerie Wilson, director of the Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy at the Economic Policy Institute. Her latest report shows that Wisconsin tops the nation in black unemployment. Coming up, 2015 TED Prize winner and StoryCorps founder Dave Isay joins us to share how he hopes to make the ability to record and share individual life stories available to the world. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. First StoryCorps founder Dave Isay just won the 2015 TED Prize of $1 million with the wish to enable people around the globe to share their life stories. Many of you have heard StoryCorps stories on NPR's Morning Edition. These are personal, often thought-provoking conversations by people who want to record, share, and preserve their life story. When Dave Isay opened that first StoryCorps booth 12 years ago, he didn't dream that these individual conversations would become the world's largest collection of human voices ever recorded. Now he wants to use his million-dollar TED Prize to help him bring StoryCorps to the rest of the world. And he joins us now. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Nice to be here.
Well, first of all, congratulations. How does it feel to win that big TED Prize?
It's great. I mean, I have to confess that it was a little bit out of the blue, and I was, I think, the last person on the face of the earth who had never watched a TED Talk when they called me to tell me this, but it's been fantastic. And, I gave a TED Talk last week that went live yesterday where I announced this wish for the $1 million, and basically what we've done is created an app, which is available now, and you can use this app. You know, as you said, StoryCorps started in Grand Central, and it's always been two people who come to a booth with the help of a facilitator and record a story, and then it goes to the Library of Congress. And this app is kind of a digital facilitator, so now people can do StoryCorps anytime, anywhere, and record it on their cell phone, and with one tap, put it up into the Library of Congress. So it's exciting. It's really cool.
Well, let's talk about that new StoryCorps app. So how can, you know, your smartphone, whatever, help you have that deep, original, interesting conversation the way a regular facilitator would in person?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know yet because this is so new. It is kind of amazing to see the stories that are, you know, coming up on the phone. People are using it on this app. I mean, it's not the exact same experience, but hopefully we approximate it closely enough so that people can have a really good experience. I mean, you want to find a quiet room, and the app, you know, really walks you very, as a facilitator would, through the experience. It gives you our question generator, so it gives you the questions to ask, and you choose how long you want to record for. A traditional StoryCorps interview is always 40 minutes, but we know that with a cell phone, people may not want to go that long, so I think you can choose 40 or 25 or 15, and then we encourage people, if they've jumped in at 15, to keep going once that 15 minutes is up, because we know that that 15 minutes is really just kind of the warm-up time. And then, you know, if you're in a quiet room and you're listening, you know, with respect and closely and you know, are curious, then amazing things are going to happen. We know that. You know, one of the things we're seeing in the very, you know, the first hours of this is that people aren't holding the cell phone as close to the mouth of the person as they should be. So, as you know, with miking, you want to, the mic on a cell phone is on the bottom of the phone, and you want to hold it about one hand's length, spread out hand's length away from the person, whoever's speaking, you or the person you're interviewing. And other than that, it's kind of amazing what's happening.
So what kinds of stories have you gotten so far?
Well, I haven't had time to check since yesterday, but I'm actually looking at a list that came to me. There's a retired man in Colorado is interviewed by an unexpected friend, his Uber driver, about his late wife and the life they built together. A young Canadian boy asks his father questions from the StoryCorps app and learns how his grandfather ran a dry goods store above the Arctic Circle. And so on and so forth. I mean, it's very different than what we're used to. It's really kind of a beautiful thing to behold.
You must be so excited to see these stories, come in from around the world.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's just starting. I mean, it's just out. But we've had, we've had hundreds of stories come in and tens of thousands of downloads on the app. And, you know, the dream with this is it's just kind of StoryCorps writ large. What we hope to do is have people, give people the opportunity to have these meaningful conversations and connect with one another and help us remember, what's really important. And, and now kind of collect. StoryCorps has always been kind of a wisdom collection project. And I think what's going to happen now is we have the opportunity to really collect the wisdom of humanity. So, to me, the technology is the easy part, even though my team worked very, very hard over a very short period of time to develop this app, which is still a beta version. But the hard part is getting people to actually use it. I'm hoping that that folks will pick it up and give it a whirl. It's hard to have these conversations, but, we've done tens and tens and tens of thousands of these, and nobody's ever regretted it.
We're talking right now with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay, talking specifically about the new StoryCorps app, which is being facilitated by Dave's recent win of the 2015 TED Prize. And you said that these stories that people collect, it's often like the final story that you really want to sum up your relationship with someone that will say the things you've always wanted to say, that you hold in your heart. Why is it that these things happen in StoryCorps stories?
Well, I mean, I think it's what you hear on the radio are short excerpts from 40-minute interviews, and we do hundreds and hundreds of interviews for every story you hear on the radio. And each story we think of as equally valuable and hopefully an important, sometimes a sacred moment in people's lives. I think it's the formality of the interview process, knowing that it's going to go to the Library of Congress, sitting there with all of your gadgets off, except now for your cell phone, which has to stay on, but hopefully you've turned your ringer off. It's an opportunity, as you know, with a microphone to ask questions you don't normally get to ask. And people realize that this will be something that their great-great-great-great-great-grandkids may be listening to. I talk about in the TED Talk, how there is some similarities to, in some ways, what happens in hospice, I think, with StoryCorps. There's a hospice doctor named Ira Byock who wrote a book called, I think it's called The Things to Say Before You Die or something like that. And basically, he talks about the four things that you want to say to the people you love before you die or they die, which are thank you, I love you, forgive me, I forgive you. And in many cases, that's what happens in a StoryCorps interview. Now, hopefully, people aren't actively dying when they're having this conversation, but it's an opportunity to say those important things and almost have a sense of closure with the people who matter to you. It's kind of profound, and it's incredibly important. I mean, it's about kind of a deep connection with people who matter to you.
And we want to give an example of just the kind of stories that have come out of StoryCorps. And here's one that you played in your recent TED Talk that means a lot to you, too. It's a conversation between O'Shea Israel and the woman, Mary Johnson, whose son he killed. Could you set that story up for us a bit?
Sure. I think we'll probably hear a very brief cut. But this is one of those extraordinary kind of conversations that's happened in StoryCorps. This is a young man who 15 years ago murdered a man named Lorenium Bird. They were both teenagers, gang members. And he went to the penitentiary. He was the only son, Lorenium Bird, of a woman named Mary Johnson. And about a dozen years into O'Shea Israel's sentence, she went to the penitentiary to find out who this young man was who had murdered her son. And slowly and almost, well, surprisingly, they developed a friendship. And when he was released, when he was freed from the penitentiary, he actually moved in next door to her. And they came to StoryCorps shortly thereafter to talk about their friendship.
And here's a clip from that story.
You and I met at Stillwater Prison. I wanted to know if you were in the same mindset of what I remember from court. where I wanted to go over and hurt you, but you were not that 16-year-old. You were a grown man. I shared with you about my son.
And he became human to me. You know, when I met you, it was like, okay, this guy is real. And then when it was time to go, you broke down and started shedding tears. And the initial thing to do was just try to hold you up as best I can. Just hug you like I would my own mother, you know.
StoryCorps conversations are usually between family members, between friends. How often do you hear a conversation between people who are on different sides of something or who have come together like that after reaching a big divide?
Well, we've had every possible, you know, the StoryCorps, classic StoryCorps interviews, we've done about 65,000 of these with more than 100,000 people all across the country, 50 states, thousands of cities, 5 years old to 105 across the political spectrum. We've had every permutation of conversation you can imagine. I mean, a lot of them are intergenerational. It's someone, because it's hard to get a reservation at our booths, it's someone interviewing someone who they care about a lot because they're only going to get one shot at it in a booth. You'll sometimes have conversations like this one. You'll very rarely have two people come to have a conversation who actually don't get along. And that's not really the purpose of StoryCorps. You know, when I launched it all those years ago in Grand Central Terminal, a dozen years ago almost, I had fears of, you know, Jerry Springer kind of conversations happening in the booth and people accusing and revealing and pulling out guns. I didn't know what, you know. I lost quite a few nights of sleep worrying about it. But, you know, 65,000 interviews later, every single person who's come to StoryCorps has treated it with respect. And I'm hopeful, even though the internet, you know, tends to, it seems sometimes to bring out the worst in us, I'm hoping that that'll hold true for this app as well.
We're talking about the personal stories that make us human. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you recorded a StoryCorps conversation, or would you like to? What do you think about the power of the story, maybe to change lives? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. He just won the 2015 TED Prize, hopes to use that prize to take StoryCorps to the world. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. And do you have a story that you'd love to record for posterity? Tell us about it by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Dave Isay stays with us now. He's the founder of StoryCorps. And we go first to Steve in Evansville. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Veronica. About a year ago, I did an interview with my mother and recorded that. It was about an hour-long interview, and it was really a positive experience. I enjoyed doing it. When I started out, I hadn't really told my mom about it ahead of time. I just kind of sprung it on her that day and you know, asked her if she'd be interested in doing that, and she agreed. And so I had a list of questions and went through those, and I learned a lot of things about her childhood that I never knew, and even about her in adulthood, things that I didn't know. So and then after that, I shared it with a couple of my siblings already. My one sister said that when she listened to it, she was alternating between laughing and crying as she listened to the interview.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that experience, Steve. I want to ask you about the crying part, Dave, because you say that people cry a lot when they listen to these StoryCorps stories, and not necessarily because they're sad. Why is that?
Yeah, and they also cry when they're doing the interviews. You know, I think it isn't because they're sad. I think it's because we're... you know, other than in public radio, we're surrounded by so much kind of phoniness, and sometimes it's hard to tell what's real and what's a commercial. And with StoryCorps, it's just two people. It's an act of generosity. It's two people having an authentic conversation with each other. Very often we're hearing stories about everyday people living lives of courage and decency and generosity. And, you know, you're kind of walking on holy ground, I think, when you hear those kind of stories. It's a little bit like the opposite of reality TV. I talk about this in the TED Talk. No one comes to StoryCorps to get rich. No one comes to get famous. It's an act of love and an act of generosity. And also, you know, the power of audio and the power of voice and the power of radio, it's so intimate. It's like an adrenaline shot right to the heart. And also, you know, the voice, you can't fake it. You know, you can tell if something's authentic or something's phony. And there's something obviously very, very authentic happening in these conversations.
And you said one of the things that you took away is the knowledge that people are basically good. How did StoryCorps tell you that? Because I would think the potential, as you said, to open the mic, anything could happen. You could hear stuff you didn't want to hear, and yet that's what you came away with. People are basically good.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I came away with after 10 years of 11 years of StoryCorps is I'm much more hopeful. The facilitators who are the on-the-ground StoryCorps employees who are there present for every interview up until yesterday when, you know, the app came out, when they come back off the road doing hundreds or thousands of interviews and you ask them what they've learned, you know, the first thing they'll say is that people are basically good. And, you know, I think that you might have said early on that, you know, people were kind of selecting, self-selecting coming to the booth. But we've done so many interviews now with so many people, as I said, across the country, across the political spectrum. At this point, with this collection being so enormous, I think you've got to think that there's some, you know, truth to what the facilitators are saying. The other thing that the facilitators will say that they've learned is that you can never judge someone's internal life by how they're dressed or what they look like. And if you do that, you're always going to be mistaken.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the potential of this app that just came out. You're going to use some of your TED Prize money for this. You've got some really cool ideas about how you think this app could be used on a global scale. And one of them, and I thought this was a really amazing idea, was that you would, when someone hit their 70th birthday, you say maybe in Europe or in Africa, a new tradition develops around the app where they get an interview recorded where they can reflect on their life and what they've learned. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. Again, this is moving so quickly, and I should say this is the first call-in show that I've done since the app came out. So if anybody, I know we don't have much time left, but if anybody has anything that they want to let me know about the app, it's a good time to call in because I haven't had a chance to have those conversations yet. Yeah, you know, I was just kind of throwing out ideas of how this could be used and how we can start integrating StoryCorps into our lives, you know. And, you know, the dream with StoryCorps is so aligned with what public broadcasting is about. It's about civil conversation and recognizing the dignity and beauty and poetry and the stories all around us when we take the time to listen, learning about listening, you know, and trying to move the needle on making us a more, it's up till now, compassionate and thoughtful, you know, country that treats every life and every story with dignity. And now I guess it's global. I threw out the idea of traditions around the world where someone at 75 is interviewed for StoryCorps, which would be great. I mean, the thing, we're going to focus still domestically for a while. And one idea that we have, which I haven't taken forward yet, but I think we're going to try and do, is that over Thanksgiving this coming year, we're going to see if we can get the whole country to do a kind of a national homework assignment where every high school kid who's in U.S. history interviews a grandparent or another elder over Thanksgiving, so that in a single weekend, an entire generation of Americans can be honored in this way. So it's, you know, obviously this app opens up so many opportunities that just weren't there before. It's really exciting.
We're talking with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay about the new StoryCorps app and also the power of storytelling. If you've got some feedback on this app already, or you want to share your own story about interviewing someone, maybe being interviewed, you can call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's listen to a little bit more. This is also from your TED Talk. This is 12-year-old Joshua Littman, who has Asperger's syndrome, interviewing his mother, Sarah.
Did I turn out to be the son you wanted when I was born? Like, did I meet your expectations? And
you've exceeded my expectations, sweetie. Because, you know, sure, you have these fantasies of what your child's going to be like, but you have made me grow so much as a parent because you think...
Well, I was the one who made you a parent.
You were the one who made me a parent. That's a good point. But also because you think differently from, you know, what they tell you in the parenting books.
Yeah.
I really had to learn to think out of the box with you. And it's made me much more creative as a parent and as a person.
There we heard a little of a conversation between 12-year-old Joshua Littman and his mother, Sarah. He's not so little anymore. He was all grown up and at your TED Talk with his mom. What does this story mean to you, Dave?
Well, I should say there's a little backstory to that also. It's a remarkable interview, and we showed an animated clip actually in the TED Talk. We've animated some of these StoryCorps stories, it's just a very powerful conversation between two people, and is about kind of the power of love and the brilliance of this kid. You know, he had gotten, after the story ran on public radio, he received hundreds and hundreds of emails from public radio listeners. And, you know, kids with Asperger's often, you know, are picked on at school. And his mom bound that book, those emails into a book, and they'd read them together when he came home from school and had been picked on. And, you know, in the TED Talk, I talk about my own story and how I had interviewed my dad a bunch of years ago, 10 years ago, and never thought about it until he was diagnosed with cancer and died very, very, very quickly. And I listened to it for the first time on the night that he died, and how this is the only way that my children are going to get to know this person who was such a towering figure in my life. And sadly, you know, Sarah and Josh were at the TED Talk, and as Sarah was flying home back to Connecticut, her mother died very suddenly as well. And she had recorded a StoryCorps interview with her mom and wrote to me when she got back that that was now the only record she had of her mom's life and how glad she was to have it. So that was a sad but kind of poignant reminder of the importance of seizing the day and having these conversations and doing these interviews with the people we care about.
As you said, your app is new. You've been out there talking about the power of stories for a long time, but what is your biggest dream for the potential of this new story collecting StoryCorps app?
Well, you know, I think about the famous Robert Kennedy Ripples of Hope quote, where he talks about tiny ripples of hope someday coming together and creating a kind of a tidal wave making the world a better place. And, you know, that's what I hope, that it creates little ripples of connection, of hope, of compassion, and that it makes us, as I said earlier, a world that gets along better and recognizes the value in every single life and every single story. I mean, personally, I used to do radio documentaries for public radio, and what excites me most is the idea of people going into, you know, senior centers or hospitals or maybe even prisons, you know, although that's a very difficult thing to do, armed with the app and you know, listening to and giving voice to people in our society who feel least heard and helping them recognize, you know, the value in their life and story. And that would be a dream of mine.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica. Great to talk to you. Be well.
We've been speaking with Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps and the 2015 TED Prize winner.